This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition. I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan, and you're listening to an all-new series that's dedicated to the superhero. Over 12 weeks, I will be taking an in-depth look at how this uniquely American invention has grown over the last century to become a global cultural phenomenon. I will be speaking to writers, artists, filmmakers, historians, collectors, geeks from all over the world, passionate individuals in love with the art form, all in an attempt at better understanding this incredible modern mythology and how it's come to bear such an influence over our collective cultures. It is something I'm calling When We Last Left Our Heroes. Episode 6, War, Politics, Superheroes. So Mark, let's begin with a question that you pose at the outset of your book. Are superheroes liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican?
Okay. I think at their base, superheroes are different than cowboys. I feel the cowboys are much more establishment American heroes. They represent law and order, and they go and they tame the wild in the West, and they're much more imperial as an establishment. I think superheroes were created more during the 20th century by immigrants, especially Jewish American immigrants, and they're much more inclined to be progressive figures, fighting for the rights of immigrants to enculturate and be free of oppression and date whoever they want to date without any fear of racist reprisals from the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that's an undercurrent of Superman and a lot of the other early figures. But there's always the potential for them to be claimed as establishment fascist figures.
Part 1. How Civil War changed my life. Well, not my life, but Mark DePaolo's life.
Oh, okay. So are we recording now? I guess so. All right. Hi, I'm Mark DePaolo. I teach English and film courses at Oklahoma City University, and I wrote the book War, Politics, and Superheroes.
That was Mark DePaolo. He is an associate professor of English and film at Oklahoma City University. In an upcoming anthology of essays about Marvel's massive Civil War storyline, Mark contributed an autobiographical piece that explains how his real-life political views were shaped by reading Spider-Man comics.
I was born in 1976, so I grew up with some of the hippie sensibilities in the popular culture, you know, the Muppets and Wonder Woman and the Beatles. But the culture got very conservative very quickly, you know, Transformers and Schwarzenegger and Ronald Reagan's rhetoric. So I grew up with this very strange dual worldview informed by both sets of popular culture that I was exposed to. So I ping-ponged politically much of my life. And so I relate to Spider-Man because Stan Lee was a little more of a traditional FDR Democrat, and Steve Ditko is much more of an objectivist and Ayn Rand fan, and both of those sensibilities are in Spider-Man. So when he gets his powers and he wants to become rich, a professional wrestler, go on the Tonight Show, that's Ayn Rand. When his uncle's telling him, with great power comes great responsibility, that's sort of the liberal Democrat worldview.
A little bit about Civil War. It was the title of this massive crossover storyline in the Marvel Universe, which pitted our favorite superheroes against one another. The United States government proposed the Superhuman Registration Act, intending to register all superpowered beings as living weapons of mass destruction and requiring all costume heroes to unmask themselves before the government and subject themselves to federally mandated standards. As you can imagine, not everyone was thrilled with the idea of being an agent of the USA, and the top hero opposed to the measure was Captain America. Believing the act to be a flagrant abuse of power, Cap went underground and began amassing an army of like-minded heroes, such as the Punisher, Hercules, and many other street-level heroes. On the other side of the coin, Tony Stark believed that the Superhuman Registration Act was the natural next step in putting an end to a possible war between heroes and villains, while also holding heroes accountable for any potential damage they might do while heroing. Stark was joined by a lot of the heavy hitters of the Marvel Universe, along with the big brains, Mr. Fantastic, Ant-Man, Spider-Man. The battle lines were drawn and the two warring hero armies began fighting one another with casualties and heartbreak along the way. Now, let's get back to Mark.
And so when Civil War comes along, and at the time I read it as Iron Man is Dick Cheney, this is the Patriot Act, they're building in surveillance, spying on Americans to root out internal domestic terrorism. The other dimensional prison was Guantanamo Bay, and that Captain America was representing this non-existent Democratic Party, because they really rolled over on a lot of what Bush did. The press wasn't really doing its job. So he was, the four or five stand-up comedians and documentary filmmakers that were taking a stand. And so that's how I read it. And when Spider-Man didn't know who to side with, that was sort of how I felt, because as a New Yorker, I was horrified by what happened to the World Trade Center and Staten Island, where I lived. A lot of cops and firemen were killed. And I understood the anger when Richard Gere would say, we need to understand why we were attacked. The cops and the firemen didn't want to hear any of that nonsense. But I knew there was a danger that we were angry and we'd lash out at the wrong people, that we wouldn't use any diplomacy. And I'd read a newspaper article by Marina Warner that said that Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, and this fantasy could really fuel our desire to just kick ass and not think, and that fantasy and comic books are very dangerous at this time. But Civil War was pretty thoughtful. And so when Spider-Man was scared and was going to go with Iron Man, that reflected how I felt when I looked at the ruins of the World Trade Center. But when Captain America said, we're giving up our freedom, we're becoming what we hate, that really resonated, especially since a lot of the people who were becoming politically powerful because of 9/11 were some of the worst American politicians. They were flag wavers, they were anti-intellectual, and they had been in disgrace, Giuliani and Bush before 9/11. Bush was accused of stealing the presidential election. Giuliani did nothing his second term but have an affair. And yet suddenly these guys were our John Wayne, Jack Bauer figures. So when Spider-Man switched sides, that felt right to me. I said, I'm going to leave this reactionary, militarized side that uses patriotism as a weapon, that's only speaks and only gives lip service to tolerance and to negotiation. Even if the Democrats who exist, the real ones, are lame, or there's not many of them, or I wish they were smarter or better tacticians, it's still the right side to join, even if we're going to lose. And I think that's how I felt when I saw Spider-Man joining Captain America's side. It was sort of a ragtag bunch of urban people. So the story really resonated, and it amazed me how big an effect it had on me, because I have a PhD in English and I read Dante and Milton, and yet this goofy comic book changed my life more than most serious political science or philosophical tracts I've read. I guess it's because watching these guys, who usually are depicted, especially in the Marvel equivalent of Super Friends cartoons, where they all have the same personality, they're all on the same side, their moral compass points in the same direction, having them fight almost feels like you're a kid caught in a divorce. They're disagreeing on what good is. I thought Captain America and Iron Man are on the same side. And it just felt like I felt looking at the news and watching people who all wanted to defend America but didn't know how to do it. And each one accused the other of ruining America if they win, or being stealth traitors. And this comic really, I think, tapped into how horrible a feeling it was watching your parents fight, kind of thing.
There is so much happening in Civil War, and I think one of the most scathing critiques of the American political dynamic, or the current political dynamic, can be seen in that transformation of Spider-Man, in that he has the courage to admit when he's wrong, something many political pundits, commentators, sides aren't willing to do. And even more than that, Spider-Man being able to appreciate the virtue of a good argument, which seems completely lost in the current political debate that plagues America. Is there a risk, as Marina Warner expressed in the New York Times, that we're embracing this very dangerous black and white view of the world?
I think so. I think over the years she's become more correct. I think she was very broadly correct when you look at something like the 300, or the way Troy played in The Coming Attraction. There did seem to be a new era of war movie. Women's films were gone. You didn't see any of those nice Miramax, Cate Blanchett films after 9/11 the way you did before. So broadly, she was right, but I still felt that movies like X-Men and V for Vendetta were giving critiques of the Bush industry that were rarely seen. But the longer the battle scenes are, the more macho the men, the more problematic these movies get. And I'm particularly upset with DC, the way they darken Superman, Wonder Woman. Batman's Batmobile becomes more and more like a tank with each film. It really should just be a sports car with a cool Bat logo on it. But he's becoming so... Yeah, I can't see the distinction anymore between Batman and the police that shoot unarmed black people. And it's making it very hard for me to like Batman, even though he was the first superhero I liked as a kid. I have to now watch Adam West. I'm okay with Batman Begins a little bit because there's some whimsy, even as stripped down as that is. But I don't know what Nolan was saying about Occupy Wall Street with The Dark Knight Rises. That was pretty politically incoherent. I wonder if he was throwing bones to everybody in that film and everybody saw what they wanted to see, which means no one thought about anything. Whereas Civil War, I think, really had the potential to change people's minds. I've known people who've been affected by it. Nolan's movies just seem all over the map, and I don't know what he's doing.
Nolan's Batman seems like he's trying too hard to build a great American narrative, which just happens to feature a guy in a mask.
Well, I guess one of the hallmarks of conservative fiction is, not all rich people are evil. This rich person's good. And there is something powerful about when an American thinks about rich people, if they think of Bruce Wayne, like, oh, well, he'll take care of the rainforests. Don't worry about it.
Ingenious costume. Let me guess. Trust fund, goody-goody.
Feeling good, huh?
Yeah, well, you almost made a monster of the mayor of Gotham City.
I'm the light of the city, and I have its mean, twisted soul. Does it matter who's mayor?
It does to me.
You on?
But more and more, I appreciate Batman Returns because Max Schreck really, really says pretty much, I'm the real America, not you. And that just seems more and more accurate. So that, to me, is the best Batman story, far better than any weirdo Frank Miller comic book, which, again, seems... I don't know, libertarian, conservative, liberal. It's a blender of odd sensibilities and horrendous depictions of women. So my favorite Batman story is Batman Returns because of that subversive take that Bruce Wayne could be wrong, that he's going to be hopelessly naive.
That was Mark DiPaolo. His book, War, Politics, and Superheroes, Ethics and Propaganda in Comics and Film, is a wonderfully critical text that examines the 70-year history of comic book superheroes and how they've changed with the politics of their time. And that's precisely what's coming up in part two. Just how much have our heroes changed? When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Hey guys, it's Uma. If you were listening on the radio, this is where we usually put music and ads, but on the podcast, you get me listing some of the things you can read, watch, and listen to if you're enjoying this series. Now, Mark DiPaolo's book is called War, Politics, and Superheroes, Ethics and Propaganda in Comics and Film. It is wonderful, a critical text that examines the 70-year history of superheroes on film and in comic books and the reflections of the politics of their time. You should definitely check it out. Also, go read Marvel's Civil War series, which are in these collected editions that you can find everywhere. Now, on to part two. You're listening to the evening edition and when we last left our heroes. Part two. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight. I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight. I'm out of range. I used to care.
Times change and so do our heroes. Superman's story speaks to the American immigrant experience. The reimagining of Batman from the world's greatest detective into a crusading Dark Knight is reflective of people's lack of faith in the justice system. The early Marvel heroes, the Hulk, Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, were born under the mushroom cloud of a potential nuclear war, when radiation and the bomb became inspirations for escape. Comic books, superheroes, they tend to be very receptive to cultural and political trends. They reflect them, they comment on them, and sometimes they even inaugurate them.
I'm not sure we're going to find direct connections between superheroes and policy, but I think that the superhero story itself, the the idea of the superhero and the superhero narrative has been something that's helped construct how America views itself globally.
That was Matthew Costello.
Okay, I'm Matthew Costello. I'm a professor of political science at St. Xavier University in Chicago. I teach international relations and American politics, focusing on political culture. For the last 15 years, I've focused on popular culture in film and comic books. In 2009, I published a book called Secret Identity Crisis, and I published several articles and edited a couple of journals on the issue of superheroes in politics. I think it's quite interesting that the American superhero narrative and America's rise to globalism emerge sort of simultaneously. The same month when Captain America first appears punching Hitler on the jaw is the same month that Henry Luce publishes his famous essay on the American century. And so I think that we can see a certain coincidence of the two coming together, and that the superhero has been used to sort of tell us how we should behave as Americans, to sort of triumph our successes as Americans, but also to reflect on sort of the costs of an imperial America over the last 40 years. And it's been a venue in which we've been able to challenge American policy in a number of ways.
It's interesting because obviously it took America a few years to get into the Second World War, but a lot of the narratives that took place in the Golden Age comic books and in the Silver Age comic books almost pushed for an interventionist ideology.
Oh, they do. The Captain America comic book was on the newsstands in December of 1940, which is a full year before America enters the war. And this was a time, of course, when there's also great sort of sentiment to not enter the war, but the superheroes were very much part of that. Even though Superman, in his comic books, never fought in the war, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster wrote a four-page story in Look magazine that was published in 1940, in which Superman flies to Berlin and captures Hitler and flies to Moscow and captures Stalin and drops them both off at the League of Nations to be arrested and tried. So there was very much an interventionist aspect on the side of the superheroes at that point.
And of course, that is in stark contrast almost to what happened post 9/11.
Oh, yes, that is in stark contrast post 9/11. The superhero comic books particularly were not nearly as triumphalist. By the 21st century, it was very hard to assert that sort of moral certainty without irony in the United States. And so the superhero comics after 9/11 are not celebrating sort of American virtue in the world, but actually really question American culpability in the attacks of 9/11.
In 2004, Mark Waid wrote the Fantastic Four story, Authoritative Action. In it, Reed Richards and his team attempt to liberate the nation of Latveria from the tyrannical Dr. Doom, but find that the people they have come to save are just as afraid of the Fantastic Four as they were of Doom. Actually, here's Mark DiPaolo again with a little analysis.
So Reed's going in there to put in democratic elections, and you know, all of his motivations are positive, but he's an American who's come in, and Dr. Doom had, I believe Dr. Doom had installed free health care and universal education and employment, so no one really liked Reed because he wasn't as good at maintaining that, and they didn't trust him with the weapons, and so S.H.I.E.L.D. came in, and they asked him why he acted unilaterally. What I believe was going on was Waid was positioning Reed as someone who had much more moral authority to go into Latveria than we had to go into Iraq. So if Reed couldn't smoothly take over Latveria, why did we expect, with very questionable evidence of weapons of mass destruction and an invented connection between Osama bin Laden and Iraqi leadership, that we would think that would go smoothly and it would be a walkover?
Authoritative Action was an astute commentary on both the War on Terror and Operation Iraqi Freedom. The superhero was no longer the all-conquering savior. Executive action wasn't something to be celebrated.
Yes, and even, I mean, particularly after 9/11, even executives are not treated particularly well. There's a Captain America storyline by Reber and Cassidy, in which sort of Captain America is at the rubble of 9/11 and helping to find people, and then gets involved in an anti-terrorist movement. But he in the process, he actually comes to the conclusion that the terrorists actually have legitimate claims at a certain level, that the United States' global adventurism had caused a lot of damage around the world. And there's a moment in which he equates the attack of 9/11 with the firebombing of Dresden in World War II, suggesting that, you know, sort of the U.S. pioneers terrorism. There's an Avengers story in which the Secretary of State is the Red Skull in disguise, and he releases a bioweapon at Mount Rushmore, which turns out to have been something the U.S. was plotting. And it ends with Captain America telling President Bush, "We're watching you." Authorities are not given the same kind of allegiance, the same kind of sort of a moral pass that they got 40 years ago, 50 years ago in the comic books. And even in the wake of such a nationalist symbolic attack as 9/11, you didn't get the same kind of outpouring of support in the comic books, unquestioning support that you would have gotten in the wake of Pearl Harbor, or even before Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and you know, and that happened quite a bit even in the 60s. I suppose that's when America began getting disillusioned with their politicians after Watergate, Captain America not trusting Nixon and becoming Nomad. I mean, even the Adam West Batman series, the police are so inept and ineffectual.
I mean, it starts in the 60s, sort of the late 60s. And this in part, again, is that, you know, the United States has now been playing a global role for 20 years, and we're starting to see the costs of playing that role in Vietnam, or the costs in Central America, the costs in Africa, as well as the costs at home, in that the economy is starting to unravel, the presidency is getting too powerful and unconstrained, and people start reflecting on, well, what are the costs of all of this? And so you get, for instance, Dennis O'Neill and Neil Adams, who do a very famous run on Green Arrow, Green Lantern, where they go on a trek in search for America. You get Captain America's Watergate story, where he gets disillusioned about Richard Nixon. But also through that same period in Captain America, you have this constant concern with the issue of race, because he's partnered with the Falcon, who is the first African American superhero. We also get stories in Wonder Woman, and stories in Spider-Man, and stories in Iron Man, that are all these sort of questioning of the should we be playing this global role? What are the costs of this global role? I think in 1972, Iron Man goes back to Vietnam, or reflects on going back to Vietnam and realizing that it was all a big mistake, and Stott decides he's not going to make weapons anymore and dedicates himself to being an industrialist for peace. Superman becomes a citizen of the world. And so it is at that period that we already start to see that questioning of what are the costs of empire, what are the costs of being a global player. It extends into the 1980s, and I think that by the 21st century, we've just completely come to question. And part of this comes out of the 1980s, when we use the superhero in some ways to reflect on American power. And the three great seminal texts of the 1980s are Howard Chaykin's American Flag, Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns, and Moore and Gibbon's Watchmen, all of which set the superhero in the context of sort of a senile Cold War, and look at sort of how the superhero is failing, and take the superhero apart. And in so doing, they're sort of looking at how these great superpowers are failing and are taking that apart as well. And in the wake of the reflections of the 60s and 70s, the deconstruction of the superhero in the 80s, by the 21st century, there's no way we can possibly use the superhero to just haul up and say, yes, America is great, America is moral, America is fine.
Coming up in part three, Superman renounces his citizenship. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. It's me again, more reading for you. Secret Identity Crisis, Comic Books and the Unmasking of Cold War America is the book by Matthew Costello, whom I've been speaking to, and it follows the trajectory of the breakdown of the Cold War consensus after 1960 through the lens of superhero comics. It's a hugely fascinating read for anyone curious about how superheroes affect the real world, and vice versa. And now, part three. This is the evening edition, and when we last left our heroes.
Send me out to the bombing. Send me
Part 3, One Nation, Indivisible. Times change, and so do our heroes. In the Milestone Action Comics number 900, Superman makes the announcement that he's going to give up his U.S. citizenship. I intend to speak before the United Nations tomorrow and inform them that I'm renouncing my U.S. citizenship. I'm tired of having my actions construed as instruments of U.S. policy, he says, following accusations from both the United States and Iran that he caused an international incident in Tehran. Truth, justice, and the American way, it's not enough anymore. The world's too small, too connected. It was about 5 years ago, wasn't it, when Superman renounced his American citizenship?
Yes.
And that was a very interesting moment for me because on the one hand, the reason given was, oh, you know, I don't want to be seen as a puppet for your wars. I am a citizen of the world. But on the other hand, the more cynical side of me took it as Superman almost giving up on America when he was supposed to represent the best of America.
It reminded me of a revisiting of some of the Captain America stories from the 70s where he says, I can't wear the American flag anymore. We're in Vietnam. So he takes it off. I respect him for that because, like, well, you know, I would feel the same way if I were him. But then he sees crazier people putting on the Captain America outfit. And he's like, oh, well, if I relinquish my responsibility to represent the best of us, then the flag will only be waved by nuts. So he has to get back in the costume. And I respect him for that, too.
That, again, was Mark DiPaolo. Truth be told, that isn't the first time our superheroes have had bouts of internationalism. The Justice League once created an European division. The Green Lantern famously declared that he was a protector of the entire planet and not just the United States. Even Captain America, feeling disillusioned and disenfranchised by Nixon and Watergate, shed his star-spangled suit and took on the moniker of Nomad.
The Superman story, the incident that was in, was it issue 900 of Action Comics?
Yeah.
That Dave Goyer wrote. It was a fun little 9 pages. And what I found almost more interesting was that within 2 weeks, the message boards on, like, the Huffington Post and Glenn Beck's website, The Blaze, had exploded about Superman renouncing his citizenship. The guys on The Blaze all wanted to say, well, he was an illegal immigrant anyway. I never saw the long form of his birth certificate. And, I mean, there were like 2,000 posts on this. I think more people posted than bought the comic book. It was an interesting little story, right, in which Superman flies to Iran during the Green Revolution and stands between the sides of the protesters and the government for 24 hours and doesn't do anything, just to stand there, to use his moral power to just be there. But when he flies back to the United States, of course, he gets chewed out by the national security advisor saying, how can you intervene in U.S. foreign policy? At which point he declares, well, I'm not an agent of the government. I am a moral actor on my own, and therefore I'm going to renounce my U.S. citizenship. Well, back in like 1971, the U.N. already made him a citizen of the world. So he's already set. He's got a global passport. We all own Superman. But this was one of those stories that, again, like the Avengers story about the biological weapon, or the Captain America story that suggests the U.S. is complicit in terrorism, that says, you know, there's something wrong with dividing the world up as states and governments. And maybe it's a globalization story that, you know, we are all just people connected to people, which is kind of facile. But this idea that the superhero needs to be driven by a moral authority and a sense of justice that supersedes the legality of the state has always been there. And I just think now it's much more overt in its confrontation with the state. And that's what shows up in the Superman story.
And, you know, that's such a driving force, even in Miller's Dark Knight. Superman has this incredible reluctance towards working for the government.
But he does it.
Yes.
But he does it. And the same thing shows up in Watchmen, where you have Dr. Manhattan and the comedian who are agents of the government, and a Rorschach who is not. But even then, the whole thing ends up with the comedian, like, realizing that all that he's done working for the government, he thought he was doing right, but now he doesn't know anymore. And so there you have that great ambivalence that, you know, if this is the only way I can be a superhero, I'll be a superhero, but there's something wrong with it. You know, I mean, in 1983, Captain America quit being Captain America rather than be an agent of the government. But today he pretty much is again, even though he's not sure that's the right way to go.
Superman has always belonged to mankind, to all of us, American or otherwise. He was always bigger than the notions of patriotism and nationhood. His virtues have always been bigger than himself, because they weren't just American, but universal. They were never ideological, but philosophical. It was never a question of politics, but rather one of ethics. Which is why his announcement to renounce his citizenship is more reflective of how America feels about herself than of how Superman feels about his nationality. It is the consequence of American intervention globally. It is a question of conscience. It is an apology of sorts. It echoes George Bernard Shaw in Man and Superman. The cry for the Superman did not begin with Nietzsche, nor will it end with his Vogue. But it has always been silenced, this cry, by the same question. What kind of person is this Superman to be? What kind of nation do we want America to be? When we last left our heroes, the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. On a slightly unrelated note, you should also check out BBC4's In Search of Steve Ditko. The documentary was part of the Comics Britannia season and follows Jonathan Ross's attempts to track down comic artist Steve Ditko. The show has an amazing roster of interviewees. It is witty, it is intelligent, and without a trace of condescension. It is an absolute model. And I think you can check it out on YouTube. And now, part four. This is the Evening Edition and when we last left our heroes.
And in fact, the whole series ends not when a decision is made on what is right, but simply when Captain America finally realizes that, you know, we're not helping people, we're just fighting to fight at this point. And so the actual issue behind Civil War, whether or not superheroes can be agents of the state and superheroes at the same time, is never resolved. If this hero is supposed to be defending the defenseless and helping the helpless and empowering the powerless, that's not what they were doing. They were just beating each other up. And the realization that that was all it was is what ends the storyline, not the resolution of the conflict, which remains.
Part 4. Bye-bye, Miss American Pie.
Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
Times change, and so do our heroes. 9/11 was a turning point. For a brief moment, we forgot about Superman and Captain America. We forgot about our escapist fantasies. For a brief moment, we looked instead to those men and women who ran into those burning buildings as everyone else was running out. But the problem with this was that our heroes were suddenly all too human. With humanity comes mortality, and so our heroes die. At the end of Marvel's Civil War, after Captain America fought tooth and nail to safeguard our civil liberties, we saw him fall prey to a sniper's bullet on the steps of a federal courthouse. This was the culmination of a storyline that would see frightening parallels to the War on Terror, the Patriot Act, and President Bush's domestic surveillance program. Captain America, it seemed, was no longer an appropriate role model for our times. The hero as savior was passé. He isn't real enough or human enough. So much so, his replacement, Bucky Barnes, was someone as disenchanted and ambivalent as the country he stood for. He was more anti-hero than superhero.
Yeah. Okay, I actually really liked... I'm a big Captain America fan. Have been since I was like 9. So I completely admit to having absolutely no objectivity whatsoever in this area.
Matthew Costello is a professor of political science at St. Xavier University in Chicago.
And when Ed Brubaker took over and said he was bringing back Bucky, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be horrible, even though I really liked Ed Brubaker. And he did it so well and so perfectly, and it was such a great storyline. And I actually thought when they killed Captain America and Bucky became Captain America, this was perfect, and you should keep this going. The death of Captain America, I mean, Marvel loves to sell these things. They call it the death of the dream, and Joe Quesada said it means whatever you want it to mean. But there was this idea that the killing of Captain America was the killing of this old World War II sense of morality, this 1940s triumphalist, that this dream is what we fight for, and we are freedom, and we are democracy, and we are pure. And that in the 21st century, you really couldn't do that. And replacing him at that point with his ex-partner, Bucky, who had been a Soviet assassin, a brainwashed Soviet assassin, who had now come back to the side of good. But it brought to the role of Captain America in the 21st century someone who melded both all those aspirations and hopes of the 1940s with an understanding and a realism of sort of the costs of Cold War and empire and that sort of thing. There's actually the same argument had been made back in 1973 in a Captain America and the Falcon comic book between Captain America and Nick Fury, where Nick Fury was fighting with Captain America, arguing that you're the hero people want. When they want a hero, they want you blue-eyed, blonde-haired, innocent, pure guy. They don't want a grizzled old cold warrior like me who's now dirty because I had to do all these things. I had to assassinate people and I had to overthrow governments all to defend my country. You didn't have to do that crap. You can still be pure. Well, in the 21st century, that purity is no longer acceptable. We don't buy it anymore. We don't think it's real anymore. You can't assert that America is this morally virtuous, wonderful, democratic place anymore without really a sense of irony. After, you know, overthrowing governments and prosecuting wars and subsidizing death squads in Central America, it's really difficult to say we're a force for moral good in our promotion of democracy. We may still hold to those dreams and those aspirations, but the reality is that's not what we always do. And the character of Bucky as Captain America sort of accepted that and reflected that. And I think it's quite interesting that after they brought Captain America back, they couldn't even keep him as Captain America for very long, because now they've made him old and retired him and made his ex-partner the Falcon Captain America. So they're having a lot of trouble with Steve Rogers today.
But while Marvel may not know what to do with Steve Rogers in the comic books, they may just be onto something at the movies. Here again is Mark DiPaolo.
Well, what do you think of the Captain America and the Marvel films? Because my take on it, I like how earnest he is. He seems like a good guy. And, you know, the snarky Gen Xer tends to not gravitate towards him. They tend to prefer Robert Downey Jr. And there's a reading of him that he's very libertarian, that he's somebody that can be co-opted by the NRA as just hating any sort of government regulation. But he just seems like such a decent guy that I think that is potentially really subversive, while it's seeming like bringing back the best of old-fashioned values, you know, Norman Rockwell without segregation. Does that make sense?
I think that's one of the strongest things Marvel has pulled off, in that Tony Stark, even the dilemma that Bruce Banner has to face hasn't really changed very much from Bill Bixby and the Incredible Hulk from the TV show. But Captain America, they've managed to pull off an earnest character who is conflicted and yet still wants to do the right thing in a 2015 setting when everyone who's watching it is looking for dark, woeful, dour, and just downright miserable, because that's what people are flocking to see. And Captain America in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is what Superman should be.
Absolutely. What I think Wonder Woman should be like in the comic books, but they've turned her into an evil Xena. Yeah, he's answered the call that I've been silently rejecting at Marvel and DC for somebody to pick up the mantle from the more pacifistic incarnations of Doctor Who or Wonder Woman or Superman. You know, I was like, ah, here he is. And what's weird for me is I had always been resistant to Captain America growing up because I thought he was the guy most likely to tell us to brush our teeth before we go to bed. And I always thought he was pretty boringly written. But Chris Evans says he based his performance on a friend of his who just has tremendous integrity. And I think his performance is amazing. And even when he's a joke, he's not. When he says stuff like to Black Widow, like there's something like there's only one God and he doesn't look like that. And it's adorable. But I love it. Like, and there's sentiments that could be really problematic, but not out of Captain America's mouth.
In Captain America, 250 when he was offered the presidency, when he said, you know, we want you to run for president.
Right.
He says no in a great way. And he says no by saying, as president, I have to reflect the reality of America. But as Captain America, I reflect this perceived America, what we all want America to be.
Yeah.
And do you think that's what superheroes should be? That's what comic books should be? Because, you know, I love these stories, and so many of these stories are great and fantastic. But I often feel they trip over into the cynical just a little too much these days.
Yeah, I'm on your side. They are very cynical. My favorite sort of Captain America soliloquy actually comes in, I think it's issue 183, when he stops being Nomad and he becomes Captain America again. And it's the end of that whole Watergate cycle where he had quit being Captain America because he couldn't serve a country. He couldn't represent a country where the president was a crook, where the governments were immoral, where he essentially defines them as the equivalent of Nazi Germany. He says these guys are every bit as bad as the Red Skull, the uber-Nazi he faces. But his conclusion, ultimately, his initial conclusion is, I can't be Captain America. But after not being Captain America, his final conclusion based on this is that it's not the government's failure, it's his failure. Because he thought that the dream would take care of itself, and he ultimately decided that he needed to defend the aspiration, he needed to defend the hope rather than the reality, that he needed to be ready to police the government as well as enemies foreign, right? The oath is foreign and domestic. And so that's the same reason he couldn't be president. And I that's what always got me as a kid, was these notions of there is a morality and there is a justice that these guys stand for. And it's hard to assert that anymore. I mean, I think that in a world where airplanes become guided missiles, where children are used as suicide bombers, where in the 21st century we have three American cities erupt in race riots, where we cut government spending and social programs and extend it on the military, and the military is frequently a first use for anything, where refugees get turned away from borders, it's really hard to assert those kinds of, you know, we are these moral actors. And it's really easy to become cynical. And the superheroes reflect that cynicism, too. And I miss that aspiration for something more myself. I once gave a lecture on the Watergate story and Captain America to a bunch of students' parents. I called it How Captain America Taught Me to Stop Worrying About Watergate. And when I came out, one of the fathers came up to me and he said, you know, I had them all. I had Fantastic Four number one, and I had the Hulk one, and I had the Captain America 100. I had all those things. He said, and I still believe in all that stuff. I still believe in justice, and I still believe in morality, and I still believe we can do better.
The day the music died, and they were singing bye. American Pie drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day.
We shun the selfless because we can no longer relate to them. We embrace the flawed and the fallen because they remind us of ourselves. We are so often faced with the choice between the lesser of two evils that we find it hard to believe that good even exists anymore. In these uncertain times, more than ever, we need our heroes to be immortal, because when they die, their values die with them. When we last left our heroes, the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.